This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 29 was recorded on September 1st, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Labor Day weekend is upon us, and for oil traders, that means we're moving out of summer driving season and into shoulder season, with fall refinery maintenance fast approaching. So we've decided to bring you a completely oil-centric show this week, with petroleum geologist Art Berman returning as this week's featured guest. Art and I will discuss oil market fundamentals, including comparative inventory, oil price cycles, recent rig count growth in the Permian Basin in particular, and finally, we'll compare notes on long-range price forecasts. Art sent us a fantastic book of charts and graphs to accompany his interview today, and I highly recommend that you download them before listening to the interview. Registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, you can register a free account at macrovoices.com, and once you're logged in, you'll find the download in our research library. After my interview with Art, hashtag OOTT founders Lisa Ward and Samir Madani will be joining Aaron and me to bring us an update on the phenomenal growth of OOTT since we first introduced you to them several months ago right here on this program.
And I'm Aaron Chan. Finally, I get to open a show without declaring yet another week and another all-time high in the S&P stock index. Well, this week saw some softness and no new all-time highs and a close on Thursday of 2168. So, Eric, what's the outlook here and is the top finally in on this equity market?
Well, I don't know, Aaron. You know, seasonality speaking, it's about the right time of year. A lot of people subscribe to a belief that stock market crashes happen in October. And in reality, if you look at the historical data, usually if there's going to be that big stock market crash, the high is actually in August sometime, the volatility picks up in September, and then the worst of it is in October. So are we headed into something like that, as so many very smart people are predicting? I don't know. You know, I do think that all the economic signals tell me that this market is too overvalued. But the last time that you expect a market to crash is when everybody's expecting it to crash. And there's an awful lot of people that have expressed a very bearish view. At the same time, if you look at some of the data, you know, things like margin interest, it tends to reflect a very bullish sentiment among traders. So I don't know what's going to happen. I definitely think that the economic fundamentals do not support these valuations and the market ought to go down dramatically. But frankly, I've thought that a lot since 2009, and the tape action has made a fool out of me each time. So the reason I'm not going short here and jumping on the short bandwagon is simply because each time I've thought the market ought to crash or substantially correct since 2009, you know, the Fed shows up with more artificially printed money and saves the day. And until we see something tie their hands so the Fed truly is out of bullets, which I don't think they are, I think they're going to continue saving markets. So I don't know what's coming. Looks like maybe we're seeing the beginning of a downside. We'll see what happens.
Well, speaking of bearish views, your call on crude oil looks to have been proven right, as WTI finally looks to be rolling over this week. Obviously, we're going to have considerable expanded coverage of oil markets in our feature interview with Art Berman, but let's at least cover the inventory numbers and short-term outlook now.
Okay, well, 2.3 million barrel build on national inventory of crude oil. There was an expectation of a much smaller build, so we saw a bigger than expected build. And remember that seasonally speaking, we shouldn't be seeing big builds yet. They usually come in the next month or two. Cushing, on the other hand, was a 1 million barrel drawdown. So that offsets the large build a little bit. Gasoline, 691,000 barrel drawdown. Distillates, on the other hand, a huge 1.5 million barrel build on inventories in distillates. There was a very small decline in production of about 0.7%. So net-net, these things do come together between the huge distillates build and the much bigger than expected national inventory inventory build on crude oil. Yeah, it's a bearish message, but I said last week, you ain't seen nothing yet. I don't think we've seen anything close to the worst of it. We're getting to that turning of a corner from summer driving season into shoulder season. I think really big inventory builds are coming, and I think big Cushing inventory builds are coming. Hasn't really started yet, but we're starting to see it move in that direction, and already the market is tanking, testing $43 even earlier today. So, you know, we're looking at the market selling off rapidly. I think it's got a lot further to go to the downside, but we're going to need to see some more bearish catalysts. No real rhetoric out of Saudi Arabia or OPEC this week so far. I wouldn't be surprised after what we've seen for them to come up with some kind of propaganda to tell us that the next meeting is going to, you know, supposedly have a production freeze or something. I think the real key to understanding this market is to understand comparative inventory, not absolute inventory. Art Berman is going to have a very in-depth update on that topic in the feature interview. So what we need to see here, I think, to shock the market lower is some really big builds in inventory, and I think they're coming. We'll save the rest for our conversation with Art.
Right. And shifting over to gold, for the past couple weeks now, we've been talking about a technical consolidation range between 1308 and 1377. Eric, you've been saying you were leaning toward the bear case until we get out of this consolidation range. And we actually saw 1305 briefly on an intraday basis this morning. So is it time to declare a victory on this bearish call on the resolution of this trading range?
Well, not quite yet. You know, what I've said is we need a daily close below 1308. We were headed in that direction this morning, got down to 1305, and saw that support level was rejected and a rally back up to 1318 or something like that by the end of the day. So we have rejected that support level for now. I do think it will fail eventually, but it hasn't yet. It'll be the daily close below 1308 that seals the deal for me and persuades me that I was right about the bearish call.
So thanks for the quick market update, Eric. Petroleum geologist Art Berman has been one of the most popular guests we've had on this program, so we're delighted to bring him back for our Labor Day weekend oil special. As Eric mentioned at the top of the program, we highly recommend downloading the excellent book of charts Art sent us to accompany this interview. Now, registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your research roundup email. If you haven't registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com, where you can register a free account in just a couple of minutes. Once logged in, click the Research Library function on the black menu bar at the top of the screen. Then click on Guest Publications. There you'll see Art Berman's book of charts as a downloadable PDF file near the top of the list. Eric's interview with Mr. Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Returning for our Labor Day weekend show is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Art, thanks so much for coming back with us. You know, as I look at the oil market, it's very clear to me, and I'm sure it must be to you as well, that you've got to get your head around comparative inventory in order to understand this picture. But for our newer listeners who may not have heard your explanation of what comparative inventory means in your last interview, please give us a quick refresher. Compared to what? What are we talking about, and why is it so important to understand this measure when we look at the inventory numbers?
Well, sure, Eric, and thanks for having me back. It's always so interesting and fun to talk to you and to get the feedback between you know, me looking at sort of the technical fundamentals and you looking at markets. So we got two things going on, inventory and comparative inventory. And the only difference is that inventory goes up and it goes down on sort of a seasonal basis, as we're either restocking or destocking or going through plant maintenance, et cetera. And the important thing, therefore, is although total inventory is interesting and important, is to try to normalize it and to look at, well, how does this particular level of storage compare to previous years that were also going through these seasonal shifts? And so that's all comparative inventory is. I look at what's the level of storage right now compared to a four-week moving average of the same week over the last 5 years. And it's just that simple. But As with many things that are simple in the world, it just works absolutely great. And if you look at any sort of historical picture of comparative inventory and price, you just can't get a very much better negative correlation in the world, the real world of oil and gas than that. And so what I've found over the years is that comparative inventory, if you can figure out which way the trends are going and it's just data, you can pretty well understand price formation. And that's a big deal, I think. It is to me.
Okay, so in other words, what we're doing is effectively tuning out the effects of seasonality so that you're looking at inventory in terms of what it should be doing this time of year. But, you know, before we even get into relative inventory, speaking of this time of year, Art, it's the 1st of September. That means that we are at the end of what historically is a destocking season because, of course, summer driving season consumes a whole lot of energy and a whole lot of oil. So the question I would normally ask you at this point is, how much has the total stock decreased during this destocking season? But it's gone the other direction, hasn't it?
Right, and that is completely anomalous. And what we've seen is that absolute inventories have actually increased by about 6.5 million barrels over the last 6 weeks in what is supposed to be, you know, pretty much a total destocking. And so this has really been a surprising development for me and for anybody who looks at this. And this translates into really huge changes in comparative inventory. So we're adding millions of barrels a week, but in terms of comparative inventory, comparing it to years past, it amplifies that effect. And so I think in a lot of ways that helps to put the price, the downward price that we've been seeing into some context. It also helps to understand how totally artificial this latest price rally, has been. It's more about sentiment and hope that, you know, maybe OPEC or somebody's going to do something than it is about any sort of reality.
I definitely want to encourage our listeners to refer to the book of charts that you sent us. If anybody cheated and fast-forwarded to this, we did tell you earlier in the program how to get the download and where to obtain that. So your first chart here is showing very clearly that 6.5 million barrels over the last 6 weeks, when we're supposed to be destocking, we're actually increasing inventory during the middle of summer driving season, which is pretty amazing. And the second slide, I think, shows that is actually dramatically increased when you look at it at a comparative basis. So what is the second slide telling us?
So the second slide, Eric, is looking at total U.S. commercial crude oil volumes, and I look at many aspects of it, but this is the big picture. And so that 6.5 million barrels of increase translates on a comparative basis to 16 million barrels of comparative inventory increase over the last 6 weeks, and just this week alone, nearly 2.5 million barrels. So this is completely backwards to what we should be seeing. We should be seeing, at best, very little change. And just to give you some idea, this week we added 2.5 million barrels of total inventory. And a year ago on this day, we withdrew 4 million barrels. And if you look at the four-week average of 2015, we were withdrawing 1.5 million barrels. So what's happening right now is anomalous, and it says that basically what I've been saying all along is true, that we're just really we just got way too much oil in the system for prices to recover as people hope they will up to, you name your price number, but 50 plus, there's just no basis. There's no basis whatsoever in the fundamentals. Now, markets move for many reasons, and the market is the final arbiter. And so just because sometimes it goes in a direction that the fundamentals don't necessarily support, eventually it all works out, but so there is that disclaimer that sometimes markets have their own opinion and personality, and they're going to do what they do. I can't argue with that.
I just want a sanity check. You know, the way I've interpreted this, I think a lot of people who are in this market are not experienced oil traders. They don't understand these comparative inventory concepts. And they're looking at the last couple of weeks and saying, yeah, okay, these are pretty interesting inventory builds as opposed to draws. But they're not huge ones like 5 million barrels a week or something as we saw in the spring a year and a half ago. It seems to me, though, if this just happened during the middle of summer driving season, holy cow, put your seatbelt on for what comes next. Would you agree with that, that we may be on the cusp of potentially some really big inventory builds as we move into the time of year when it should be building?
Well, anything is possible. That's certainly what I'm going to be looking for. You know, we're seeing some things developing here that break the paradigm of the past, and that shouldn't be too surprising in a way, because ever since the price collapse, I've been saying and writing that we've crossed a boundary, and so many of the things that we used to think were kind of the rules of the game, or at least the framework, many of those we're not so sure about anymore. And so, you know, what I see going on here basically is that we're seeing inventory changes and comparative inventory changes that are happening at such a high storage that they're not really changing the overall picture for price formation. And so we go up and then we realize the truth and we go back down. So my expectation is, first of all, I don't know, because I'm not strictly speaking a price predicting kind of a guy. But if we're seeing inventories and comparative inventories building, you know, in August, then, like you say, Eric, I mean, you know, buckle up, because we could see some changes coming up that could drive prices, you know, down, possibly, you know, below $40 again. So what I see is that what's happening is anomalous based on the fundamentals. And I'm curious, Eric, I mean, are you seeing any kind of commensurate anomalous reaction in the futures market? Because that's a little bit, you know, I follow them, but I'm outside of my expertise and purview.
Yeah, something really strange is going on, Art, in the last week or so. One of the things I follow very carefully is not just the absolute price. Price tends to be dictated by a lot of emotion and reactions to propaganda from OPEC and so forth, and there are wild swings in both directions. But the time spreads, the difference between price in one month and the next month, the contango in the market, is more of a reflection of how the professional oil traders are anticipating that we may come into a storage crunch in the fall. So what we were seeing during the sell-off in prices down to $39 was a dramatic widening of those time spreads. So people are basically saying the value of storage around fall maintenance season, refinery maintenance season, there was a lot of expectation building that we were going to have a real storage problem. Now, as we've had this production freeze propaganda hope rally that has taken us from $39 back to $47, of course, as the less volatile, longer-dated contracts are more stable in price, the front month is rising, you see some compression, some contraction and narrowing of those spreads. And that's certainly to be expected in the environment of a rising front month price. But this week, we've seen nothing but basically straight down in reaction to inventory numbers in terms of the front month price. But those time spreads, what you would expect to then start to widen again as a result of the front month price dropping, they're not widening. They're still contracting, which says that the longer dated contracts are being sold even more aggressively than the front month is. And the price is being driven down in those longer dated contracts more dramatically than the front month price is being driven down. you know, how the heck do you explain that? Either somebody has decided that we're not really going to have a storage problem this fall after all, and that's very hard for me to reconcile how anybody could think that based on what we've just discussed in terms of inventory growing so dramatically at a time when normally you'd be expecting drawdowns. All I can think of to explain this is producer hedging, that maybe the producers who are not fully hedged are looking at prices rolling back over and saying, oh crap, we thought this thing was over, it's not over, we're headed into another leg down, we better just sell at any price we can get in order to lock in at least a break-even price where we can survive whatever comes next. Obviously, they should have hedged back when prices were $51.65 or whatever they topped out at, but they didn't do that. I can't find another way to explain it, but something very anomalous is happening this week with the front month dropping and the time spreads still compressing. We also have had a month-end effect, and I notice as we're speaking today on Thursday, it's the first of the month, those spreads are starting to widen just a little bit, whereas they were narrowing over the last two or three days that the front month was selling off. So it may have been somebody trying to, you know, get their hedging done before the calendar month ended or something like that. I'm not sure, but something very funny is going on here in terms of the term structure of the crude oil futures market.
That's so interesting, Eric, because what I see on the, you know, the more mundane daily transactions just in among the oil companies and their contracting of rigs and their going to the credit markets is that I certainly expected that with the prolongation of relatively low prices into 2016, that the credit markets would just contract considerably relative to flowing capital into the E&P companies. And I was wrong, and I think everybody was wrong. And what we're seeing instead is that it's as I wrote recently, it's a race to the bottom that the private equity has said, okay, we've got a problem. We need to figure out who the potential winners are. The field is narrowing, and the result is that capital is even more available to a smaller number of companies that are perceived as having whatever it takes to be successful in spite of lower prices. And so what I see, shockingly, is that we've had a couple of weeks of rig count increases of, 20-plus in the tight oil space, and most of those are in the Permian Basin. We had two companies last week. I think they were Parsley Energy and Diamondback Energy in the Permian Basin. They went out with secondary share offerings, got $1.6 billion in 4 hours, and had to cut it off because people wanted to buy more. So what that says to me, if you're at all paying attention and you're a producer, is this thing ain't over by a long shot. That the money is the money is there still for the right companies, and they're not just to the Permian, but that seems to be the way of it. And I think the companies are starting to say, oh man, we thought we were over the edge on this. I think you're exactly right. We better hedge, we better lock in whatever we can, because this thing isn't ending, at least in the domestic situation.
You know, I agree completely with everything you said, Art, and I would just observe, too, you talked about private equity, but also going back to public markets. You and I both predicted, last time we did an interview, we thought Saudi Arabia's goal was to cripple the funding sources, and we expected, just a massacre in the junk bond market. And what's amazing to me is if I look at the oil charts, if I look at the inventory and comparative inventory charts, it's really clear to me this thing ain't over yet. But boy, if I look at the junk bond market, it's breathing a sigh of relief as if, the worst is past and the storm is over. So the other thing that seems to have changed here is a year ago, it was very obvious that Saudi Arabia was intentionally wanting prices lower because they were trying to damage their competitors. even though they're not willing to give up market share yet, they're not willing to consider a production cut, it seems like Saudi Arabia has shifted gears to where they are willing to talk up prices. And that seems to be a change. And I don't know if that's what's changed the junk bond market or what. But, you know, my short view on junk bonds, it's getting kind of long in the tooth in terms of how long we've been waiting for a collapse in junk bonds. And it hasn't happened yet.
Right. And I think that gets back to, I don't know what Saudi Arabia and OPEC, what their feelings are, their strategy is, how it's changed. But I think it's clear that this thing has gotten away from everybody. And so, you know, we look at the global picture, and the global picture is that we have made real progress towards market balance. I've been pointing this out now for a year. It may be slow, but we've been moving in the right direction. And for the last couple of months, we've really been about as close to market balance as really we ever get. And I did a study of this, I think it was a month or two ago, the market's never in balance. And we've been less than 500,000 barrels per day of liquids globally above balance. And you compare that to the average overproduction or production surplus last year was over 2 million barrels a day. So we are very close to balance. The market should be responding differently than they are. We should see prices rising because overproduction is not the problem anymore, and yet prices are not responding. And that's got to be more than a little worrisome to a country like Saudi Arabia, whose entire apparatus depends on oil price and their strategy. Yes, I agree with you. That was where they were going. Let's cripple the capital and grab market share and drive these guys into the ground. Well, it seemed to be working, and now it's not. Now it's not. So there's something more fundamental going on here. It's not just a matter of getting global market balance in order. And that's got to be worrisome. And yeah, if they can talk the price up $4 or $5 by saying we're going to have some sort of a meeting and talk about a production freeze, that's a lot of revenue relative to what they were getting before. It's got to make a difference.
Now, the other thing that we predicted, both of us, I think, the last time we did an interview, was we thought by now U.S. production would be falling off a cliff. And it is declining, but really only just a little bit. So is that the reason that this thing is dragging on as much as it is? Because I think we had both thought that by now maybe the market would be in balance and prices higher. It seems like U.S. production is not falling off a cliff. And, of course, the rig count is rising again.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, production, every month we have to revise it. It hasn't fallen as much as predicted. And I think at this point what's happened is whatever it does on month, just about everybody who's in the business of predicting, including the EIA, is saying, pretty much September is the bottom. And whether you subscribe to the apocalyptic view of the drilled and uncompleted wells, or it's just a matter of rig count, whatever your theory is about that, I think we've gotten to the point where our expectation is that the U.S. production is not going to drop much more than it has. That has to have a psychological effect. As long as we were 6 months out and it was dropping at several hundred thousand barrels a day per month, there's hope that maybe it'll drop even more than we think. Maybe we'll get down, but we're still less than 1 million barrels a day below the peak from April of 2015. So I think the hope factor on that, even though we have cut out 800 and some odd thousand barrels a day, the hope factor has faded. It's gone. So what's the next shoe to drop? Where are we going to find the solution, the silver bullet that brings prices back to normal? And I think we're running out of options.
I want to get back to your slide deck. I think the first three slides were all about comparative inventory, which we've covered. Moving on to the fourth slide, you're getting into oil price cycles, and you're showing that there's basically about a six-month periodicity to these cycles. What do you see on the horizon? What's next?
This latest thing that just sort of came up out of nowhere, which shows up as cycle four on my chart, it was sort of had a spectacular rise. And it seems to be dying off about as quickly as it began. Now, I'm not a believer in history repeating itself, but what we saw a year ago was a very rapid increase in the end of August, surprise. You know, prices went up to 50-some-odd, rattled around, had a few little short cycles, and then crashed down to $26 a barrel by the end of 2016. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not predicting that that's what's going to happen, but it's hard not to remember that we saw something like this a year ago. Is it important that it happened at the same time of year? Well, again, we're in refinery maintenance season, and as we discussed in the beginning of the conversation, we're seeing this anomalous build in absolute and comparative inventories that we didn't see a year ago. Oh my gosh! Are people freaking out about the possibility that we're going to see another big slide? All it would take, is some more economic bad news about China. The OPEC meeting in Algiers this month doesn't produce any kind of meaningful results, which I think we agree it won't. And even if they say it does, it ain't going to make any difference. What's going to hold prices up through the part of the year that typically is not stellar for prices? Again, I'm not predicting that, but certainly something to watch for. It's surprising to me, that's what the data says, and what it's showing clearly in slide five. And here I've broken out the three main tight oil plays, the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, and the Permian, is that we're in a cyclicity here too, and that every time the price starts to go up, the capital flows and the rig count increases. And what we've seen here just in the last couple of months, since really April, is that this Permian rig count has just shot to the ceiling. I mean, it's like happy days are here. And again, we're, a culling of expectations that Saudi America has now contracted for Saudi Permian. But the more the better, because for the capital providers it means fewer choices to make, and so as prices got up to $51, the floodgates opened, and we're just putting all kinds of rigs to work out there in West Texas. Rig count's rising, and you factor that into growing inventories and comparative inventories. And we're setting ourselves up, I think, for a big fall in prices, potentially, or certainly a fall. And we're seeing a fall right now. So if you think it's over, it isn't over. And I think it's just that it's the reach for yield that drives everything. I have no doubt that the people that are putting their money in this are smart people, and they wish they had somewhere else where they can get the kind of yields that they're finding here, but they can't find it. And so they continue returning to the same old, same old. Show them a better option and they'll take it. Nobody can show them a better option. And let's face it, if you put your money in one of these secondary offerings by one of these Permian Basin companies in the beginning of August, you made a ton of money. It's a stock play. It makes sense. I hate to say it. It makes sense.
On your next slide, you're showing essentially an analysis of the comparative inventory data suggests to you about a $38 price floor for now. Now, I'm curious about that number because you and I had both predicted much lower numbers were within the range of possibility, maybe as low as $20 a barrel the last time that we did an interview. Since that interview, I noticed an article by RBN Energy about a month, month and a half ago, and they opined that the world has kind of changed since 2012, because the reason you and I both thought that we could be in for an outright price crash was all that landlocked oil in Cushing, Oklahoma. That's where the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract is settled. If Cushing runs out of storage space, oh boy, anything could happen. And RBN's observation was, you know, pre-2012, all of that was true. Post-2012, there's a whole lot of outbound pipeline capacity from Cushing down to Pad 3. So they have the ability to allow themselves to get to 99% of their working capacity and then, you know, throw the valves and turn on the pumps and solve the problem where it was previously impossible to solve that problem. Do you think that that's contributed to prices not having fallen as far as we thought they might? Or do you think that, you know, the bottom is yet to be found below $26?
I see support for that opinion in the comparative inventory data. And so I look at Cushing, I look at Pad 3 or Gulf Coast, I look at total U.S. And what I've seen evolving is that Cushing, when we talked a year ago, seemed to be driving the whole operation as far as price. What I see now, for instance, this week, is that Cushing inventory and comparative inventory actually dropped, and Gulf Coast went up. So what it seems to me has been happening, and I've seen this now for at least a month or two, is that, you know, Cushing will go up a little bit, then Cushing will go down. They're moving inventories out of Cushing into Gulf Coast. And what this slide is meant to show more than anything else is that we're locked in, you know, what I call Einstein's definition of insanity, which is to say you keep doing the same thing expecting a different result. And so what seems to be happening here is that, you know, we lower inventory and comparative inventory. Everybody says, great, you know. And so when you do that, the price goes up. And I say, whoops, price is going up. I don't want to buy any more oil. So they stop moving it in the Gulf Coast. Prices go up. Price reacts by going down. The refiners say, oh, happy days are here. Let's buy some more oil. We just keep going around and around in a circle. So that's why I didn't include it. But if you look at a 200-day moving average of NYMEX WTI futures, you come up with about the same answer, that there seems to be a floor at around 37 or 38, and there seems to be a ceiling at 51 or 52. And so neither of those things mean that it's a prediction of the future, but they're kind of supportive. So that's the way I see it, that the changes in inventory in Cushing are moving deck chairs around is what they're doing. It's not reflecting fundamentals. It's reflecting the ability to be able to move stuff out and put it somewhere else and put it. And so we see a reduction in inventory and an increase in product, okay? But that doesn't mean that anybody's consuming anymore, okay? It just means they're refining more product. And that seems to be the real conundrum.
On your next slide, you're showing that this recent growth in the rig count seems to be very much centered in the Permian Basin. And I know off the air, we've also had a conversation where one of our regular listeners, a hedge fund manager in Dallas, has sent me some information saying, you know, Art keeps saying that these guys cannot make money at $40 oil prices. And that might be true in the Bakken. But boy, there are a few operators in the Permian that have low enough operating costs that they're at least breaking even at $40. What's your response to that? How do you react to those comments?
There's no support for it. I'd like to say it's true. What I can tell you is that the Permian plays have a lower break-even oil price than the Bakken and the Eagle Ford. But I promise you, nobody's breaking even at $40 oil prices. And so when, you know, when I reviewed that hedge fund manager's information and when I routinely answer people's questions. What everybody's focused on right now, Eric, is cost reductions, okay? Everybody's just, you know, just gaga over the fact that these producers can somehow continue to bring down costs through all of their efficiencies and et cetera, et cetera. And I was on a conference call with South Africa this morning where they were asking me the same thing. And I said, look, guys, we're dealing with an equation that has a number of variables in it. And cost is a variable. It's not the main variable. The main variable is EUR, it's reserve per well. Okay, so these guys have us focused on the thing that they have been successful. And I got to tell you, I mean, it might be a 15% gain. And that's gone, I mean, there's diminishing returns there. I think we're down to 1% or 2% a year gains in, you know, potentially in efficiency. The big variable is what kind of reserves are you associating with it? And where do you get your numbers? And so most of these companies out here, they throw out a number and people don't have any way of ground truthing it. Okay, but that's what I do. Okay, that's what I do is I look at the production data, and if you plug in the correct well performance numbers, which is the big part of that equation, you just can't get there from here. You need at least, I mean, the best operators in the very best parts of the best plays in the Permian need about $50 to break even. And that's a very, very tiny little area and small number of operators. On average, the Permian guys need $60, maybe a little bit more, and that's WTI. They get about $4 or $5 less at the wellhead. So whatever WTI is, subtract $4 or $5, and that's what they're getting. So if today's price is, you know, whatever it is, and you know, the 43 or something like that, you know, what they're actually getting is 38. And so even if, you know, even if you believe, which I don't, that they can break even at 40, they're not getting 40. But I'm telling you that the big unknown and the source of a lot of this confusion is that the numbers are, my numbers just don't agree with the propaganda that I hear in the conference calls. And I'm not calling anybody a liar. I'm just saying I've been doing this for a long time. I've been in contention with those kind of numbers since 2006 in the shale gas plays, and I think time has proven that, in fact, they were exaggerated for whatever reason.
Now, another thing that seems to be confusing this market is expectations about demand growth, because, you know, EIA just recently revised their figures. They had expected a lot more demand growth in reaction to low prices. Your final slide here, you're showing this, that consumption growth you would expect to be just going up in proportion to prices coming down, but that's not really what's happened.
No, and this is a very disturbing chart, Eric. It's not what I want to see. But what this says to me, and so here again, let's be clear, we're talking about consumption growth, okay? So we're not talking about consumption, and demand is, you know, esoterically somewhat different from consumption, but it's a reasonable proxy. And what this chart says to me is that if the price of oil is low enough, then consumption or demand grows. But as soon as it gets to some relatively low price compared to where it was a couple of years ago, which is to say, you know, $40, demand growth stops. And that's a scary thing. It's saying that, you know, the analogy is that, you know, time, and I'm going to do all my shopping at Walmart instead of, you know, Safeway or Kroger or whatever, even there for any reasonable prices. And so what's happening here is, yeah, I'm never going back to Kroger. That's what it's saying. I don't have enough. I don't have enough money. The economy doesn't have enough to consume more except at rock-bottom oil prices. Now, again, I hope I'm wrong, but that's what the data tells me. And so we get back to this you know, this kind of oil price floor and ceiling that we were talking about a little bit before that was coming out at us empirically from things like, you know, trends in futures prices and comparative inventory. And this is telling me the same thing. It's telling me that, you know, that there is a ceiling, and this helps explain the inventory issue as well. That if, you know, that if people simply limit their consumption at some price level that's well lower than where everybody needs to break even, then where does it all go? Where does it all go? And at some point, it comes back to haunt us, is where it all goes. And, you know, at some point, because of this, you know, these Einstein insanity cycles that we're going through, at some point we actually run into a supply deficit, and that's, you know, that may be the, you know, that's a scary thing to me, but, you know, maybe there's hope there for, you know, for somebody who needs much higher prices.
Speaking of somebody needing much higher prices, we need to touch at least briefly on this whole OPEC meeting next month. I should say this month. It's the first already. Later this month, OPEC is meeting. There has been propaganda about a production freeze. I think you and I are in agreement that freezing but not cutting production when you're already at the maximum conceivable amount of production doesn't really make a lot of sense. What do you make of this latest round of propaganda? Is there any substance to any of this, or is it purely just political theater for the benefit of trying to talk the market up?
Well, you took the word out of my mouth, Eric. It's pure theater. The point is, first of all, I said it a few minutes ago, market balance isn't the problem, okay? And so by freezing production, forget for a minute, you know, what level that production may be, how in the world does that affect the market balance situation? It really doesn't at all. Okay, I mean, if we were talking about 2 million barrels a day of production surplus, well, you know, maybe somebody thinks that helps. But what I said before, I'll say it again: that market balance isn't the problem. And so, how in the world does a production freeze address something that isn't the problem? So I think it's theater. I think it's, as I said before, we're running out of ways to get out of this problem quickly, and so this is, you know, the deus ex machina, you know, back in the early days of the theater, and, you know, in Europe, the plot would get so complicated that the only way to resolve it was to, you know, bring God or a Greek god down from the ceiling, and he would just tell everybody, okay, now you're going to do this, and you're going to do that, and you're going to do that, and now it's all fixed, and it's okay. Well, you know, the god here, I guess, is OPEC, and everybody's waiting for OPEC to come down and set things in order, but I think the experience, certainly of the last couple of years, is they're not God, and they're not in charge. So we'll see. But, yeah, this could be setting us up for a huge disappointment, is the way that I see it.
Well, and the thing, too, is Saudi Arabia has been crystal clear that they are not going to consider any kind of production cut. They're willing to talk about a production freeze, and I think they're willing to talk about it because they know it helps prices and they know it's irrelevant and meaningless, but in terms of real-world supply and demand factors. But, you know, certainly they do have the ability to cause a lot of price volatility. This propaganda, as much as we might be able to recognize it as propaganda, it works on the market. You know, every time they come out with another statement, prices go through the roof and until the next inventory report comes out and reality sets in again. So I'd like to move on now, Art, to a little bit of an appearance of conflict. I know you and I have talked about this off the air, and it's really just a matter of understanding time frames. But one of the predictions that you've made both on this program and some of your blog posts was that when we eventually resolve this glut of oil, we're going to end up with prices going to the moon because of all of the supply destruction that's occurred in terms of deep water and tar sands and so forth. Once this this glut clears itself. But then in a later post, you talked about the cost of energy kind of crippling the economy and never getting to a full recovery. And those two things appeared to be, you know, in conflict with each other. I think that the question was really just understanding what time frame we're talking in. So could you clarify for our listeners what was going on with those two posts and try to address that apparent conflict or change of view?
Right, and thank you for asking the question, because several very thoughtful people have approached me with the same question. So I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. I haven't changed my views at all, but you're exactly right, Eric, and that is that about time. And so my view is, as I just stated, with the consumption growth issue, is that we're in a cycle of lower prices for some time to come, which is to say, you know, months or maybe even a year or a couple of years. Certainly until we work through the inventory overhang of 140-some-odd million barrels, I mean, there's really no justification in history or in logic for a return to oil prices of $60, $70, $80 a barrel. I won't say anything's impossible, but it would say we have to throw everything about the markets out the window from a fundamental standpoint. I don't think that's going to happen. So that says that we're gonna be in, you know, kind of this cycle of bouncing off of ceilings and floors at lower prices than the industry really needs to keep itself whole. And that's because the economy is weak, fundamentally, in a simple phrase. But we're deferring investments. We're deferring investments in proven reserves, okay? We're not talking about going out and exploring for more oil. All we got to do is spend a couple of $100 million or a couple of $1 billion to develop existing proven reserves, and we have deferred somewhere in excess of 20 to 30 billion barrels of proven reserve development here just in the last year and a half or two, and we continue to go down that road. And so much of the world's supply comes from deep water. I mean, all the emphasis is on tight oil, and it has been a, you know, a real source of oversupply. But the big reserves are not in the Permian Basin or the Eagle Ford or the Bakken. There's maybe 10 or 15 billion barrels, which is not nothing. But I mean, that's half the size of a fairly big discovery in ordinary years. Which, by the way, we also aren't having. So there's going to be a time that no matter how weak the economy is, no matter how much we can't change this, we're going to end up with not enough oil to meet our most basic fundamental transport and manufacturing needs. And when that happens, you will see a moonshot. Now, let's talk about the time frame of that. When we look at history, what we see is that those big spikes upward in prices, and, you know, we saw them in the 70s, and we saw them just leading up to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. How long do those things last? Well, you know, they last anywhere from a couple of months to a year, maybe 18 months. And some of that depends on, you know, whether OPEC cuts production or increases production or whatever. But when those prices spike, and I think we're talking, you know, we're talking about several years in the future, and I'm not going to predict how long, but, you know, some people think it could happen as soon as 2018 or so. Other people think, well, no, it'll be off into the early 2020s. But it's looming out there, and everybody knows it, and IEA talks about it every time that they talk. It's a big concern of theirs. And when that happens, prices are going to go up, and it's going to absolutely destroy the economy's ability to do much of anything. So it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing at all. But that's the affiliation, that in the near term of months to a couple of years, I think we're stuck in relatively low prices. We look out past there to the point that our underinvestment in proven reserves and exploration catches up with us, and then we're going to see a big moonshot, if you will, and it's going to be absolutely devastating to the global economy unless the global economy looks a lot better than it does today, and I sure hope it does, but I don't see how that's exactly going to come to pass. So that's the way I resolve that. It didn't seem like a contradiction to me, but I sure understand that, you know, that people saw it as such. So I apologize for any confusion that created.
So the big picture is essentially for the very short term, months to maybe a year or more, we're looking at low oil prices as a result of the glut that we need to work off. Once that's worked off, moonshot in prices, and that moonshot in prices will have a crippling effect on the economy. As a result of that crippling effect, we end up with tremendous damage to the economy from high oil prices. That results in both the price of oil as well as the general economy suffering a downside effect. Art, I would love to go much deeper into detail on this. Unfortunately, we're out of time, if not over time, on this interview, so I'm going to have to wrap it up. But before we go, you have a fantastic blog at artberman.com. I cannot recommend highly enough. It's free. To not subscribe to that would be crazy, so I recommend that very highly to listeners. In addition to your blog and your website, what do you do at Labyrinth Consulting Services, and what services do you offer that may be of interest to some of our institutional listeners?
I'm a working petroleum geologist, and I collaborate with working petroleum engineers and economists, and we are really, really good at evaluating companies as to their fundamentals. We do all sorts of valuations, reserve forecasts, and economic price analysis. So that's what Labyrinth does, but most of the time I make maps and drill wells. So, get on my website and see what I have to say. And if you need something, there's a contact, you know, put in a shout, and if we can help you, we'll be glad to respond.
And your blog is a free subscription, which I cannot recommend highly enough. Art, thanks so much for coming back and joining us for our Labor Day weekend show. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
So I always enjoy listening to Art Berman. And Eric, several weeks ago when we talked about Alan Greenspan's observations about the risk of a run on physical banknotes in circulation in reaction to negative interest rates, you did speculate that the powers that be might actually welcome a situation where a premium develops for physical cash over deposits held in checking accounts. And it sounded pretty outlandish at the time, but I couldn't help but wonder if our listeners would think you'd gone off the deep end. But man, did you see that some professor actually gave a speech at the Fed's Jackson Hole conference last week promoting that exact idea, intentionally free-floating the value of physical currency above its representative value in deposits accounts for the sake of creating a financial disincentive to hoarding cash in reaction to negative interest rates? I mean, you joked with me when you first said it that you'd hope you weren't giving them ideas, but did you catch this development in the news?
I did see it. Professor Goodfriend was his name. I'm not sure if he's a friend of mine because I don't agree with his views. But, I don't think he got the idea from us, but it was pretty easy to see coming, you know, and I think it really speaks to me when people say the Fed's out of bullets. They're mistaken. What they don't understand is the Fed is going to eventually go to all kinds of crazy extremes to try to keep this charade going. And, you know, Bank of Japan is already buying ETFs. At some point, I won't be at all surprised to see the Fed start buying equities, directly monetizing debt. Who knows where it's going to go? And I don't think it all really comes to an end until something ties their hand. And I'm not sure what that will be. But unfortunately, we're not there yet. So, yeah, free-floating the value of physical cash above and beyond its intrinsic value for the sake of the war on cash. What will they think of next?
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think Lance Roberts actually came up with a piece saying that Yellen speaks Japanese, and they'll probably go to even crazier extents than we had previously thought. And speaking of trends, you heard about first right here on Macro Voices before they hit the mainstream. Longtime listeners to this program will recall that several months ago, we introduced you to hashtag OOTT founder Samir Madani. But for our new listeners, Eric, please refresh our memory on what hashtag OOTT is all about and explain why we're inviting the founders back for a follow-up interview this week.
Well, OOTT stands for the Organization of Oil Trading Tweeters, and it's a community of oil traders who share research and trading ideas online. Twitter is their primary communication and collaboration platform, but they also use Google Shared Spreadsheets to publish an amazing wealth of research on oil tanker movements, economic data releases that will affect oil markets, and much more. When we first introduced you to Sam several months ago, he was basically a smart guy with a hashtag and a really great idea, but OOTT was brand new and had yet to gain much traction. Wow, how things have changed in a few months. So we're bringing back Sam and the co-founder of hashtag OOTT, Lisa Ward, to bring you an update. So Sam, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having us on the show.
Also with us today is hashtag OOTT co-founder Lisa Ward. Lisa, since this is your first time appearance on the program, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm from the UK. I live in the north of England. OOTT, now it's a hobby for us guys, so it's something that we've got involved in. I do work full time as well, so this is just part of the sideline, but the amount of hours that we put into it is unbelievable. I've been trading for about 15 months now myself. I didn't actually get into the oil market until the fundamental side of it since about April, May time, which is when Sam actually realized and found me on Twitter. I started posting out a few things, and that's where he kind of saw me and was like, can you help out? So it was from there, really, that we kind of like teamed up.
Well, fantastic. We're delighted to have you on the show. And as I said in the intro, when we first met Sam several months ago, you guys had a hashtag and a great idea, but you were just getting started. And the progress since then has been nothing short of amazing. So please fill our listeners in on the growth of the OOTT community, the recognition that you're getting on from the press and so forth.
Yes, I ran a stats update on the actual hashtag, and we have over 3 million daily impressions on this hashtag, and that means news and views that are being circulated across Twitter with the hashtag included are getting that much attention right now. And I can also add that a large portion of the content is being delivered directly by journalists working with, for instance, Bloomberg, Reuters, MarketWatch, etc. And they are including the hashtag with every article that they post out now. And they know that this actually brings them an audience as well. Because as I've encouraged over the past few months, people to click on the hashtag at least once a day and just follow up on the news that they missed out on. And this is now grown to such an incredible base of followers. We're very pleased about that. And they follow real-time events of what's going on, and we have many stories to share. And also, we have run a demographic check, and I was very delighted to see that 30% of our followers are female, and this is very encouraging considering all you ever see in the news are a bunch of old men in this industry. And I'm also working very closely with everyone who's contributing news, and a lot of that is coming from the female side of the community. And I'm very pleased because they're also bringing a lot of original material by contributing technical analysis, fundamental watch on things. And I will also say that they're very patient with rookie traders, including myself, I would like to say. And I think that they do a really, really great job.
I want to pick up on that specific topic of women participating in this because, you know, there is such an incredibly strong stereotype that trading is a male-dominated sport. And, you know, the chauvinistic view would be that women are incapable of, you know, handling such things. But, boy, if you participate in the Twitter community, all the smartest people in the room are women. I mean, if you think about it, between Lisa, Heidi, Tracy, Bryn, there's just so many people that are so well-informed that are women, and it's so contrary to the stereotype.
And Nicola, don't forget Nicola.
Oh, yeah, Nicola Duke. Don't. Yeah. We got to edit this one or we're in big trouble if she hears me forget her on that one. Nicola Duke,
she's
obviously,
an RAF
is
veteran. Watch out.
Is a total veteran. So I knew I was missing somebody important. But, I mean, and there's countless others. So what's going on here? Why is it that we have this perception that women can't trade, yet they're the smartest people in the room on Twitter?
Lisa?
How clever, Sam. Just defer to her.
Well, they are the smartest in the room.
Question.
So.
I can say from my perspective of having worked with them over the past few months is that I don't feel ashamed of asking them any question and actually getting a very nicely detailed response. And they're very patient. And I think the patience factor is something that they are much better at than us guys. We're too impulsive. We make mistakes far more often. They like to, I don't know if they like to, but they tend to stand back and look at a bigger picture before making a new move. And, you know, many of us are just zoomed in on the chart for those specific few minutes, and we're just looking at what to do next. They have a whole different view on things. I chat with a few of them, and they all look at like things like seasonality. They go back a year or two and study that and come back and say, oh, you know, in the next few weeks it's going to be like this.
And what's your take, Lisa?
Yeah, I can agree with Sam. I mean, personally, I do look back over the charts as well. Do a lot of like technical analysis as well as looking into the fundamental side of it as well. We have tweeted out a couple of things in the hashtag OTT with a few different summary charts. Now, some of those contain the different effects that has happened when we had like the QA increase with the strikes. We've had the Alberta wildfires. Obviously, those have all taken into account as well. Then obviously, we've got seasonality, all sorts. It's all affecting the markets. Also, of course, you've got your options expiry as well. So there's lots of different things to take into account. We can't just look at fundamentals and we can't just look at technical analysis. We have to combine the two and obviously look into those different patterns, what affects the markets. And I guess it's just making sure that we don't focus on just one specific thing because everything affects it. And with it being such a volatile market as it is as well, I think that's part of why I actually enjoy the market so much, just because there's so many different factors that's involved. There's so many different movements, and it's just, I just love the market, to be honest.
Right. And when Sam first appeared on this program, your tanker tracking activities were pretty much limited to just Pad 3 and the Gulf Coast. But now it looks like you've gone global. So can you please bring us up to speed on your tanker tracking efforts?
Yes. What we decided to do was, after a very successful run with not just Pad 3, but we included also Pad 1 and Pad 5, we came to, let's say, we missed the EIA report by only 1.5% margin. So we were very, very accurate. But I must say it came at a cost, and that was the countless hours that we put into it every night. And it was done, every night for months. And we decided that now, towards the summer, and given the fact that we have an OPEC meeting coming up, we decided to learn about tanker activity outside the U.S. And we decided to focus on certain areas of interest, the big ones that move markets. So we have China, we have OPEC, we have Russia, India, etc. And we really studied up on which ports to track. We looked at the maps. We looked at all the data that we could get hold of. And we plotted out everything. And we have documented as much as possible and started tracking everything that we could. Now, initially, your ambition level is really, really high. You want to do everything as much as possible. And then the reality kicks in, and that's the hours that you put into it. And so we decided that we would streamline and focus on certain areas at a time. Now, we can't do as many as possible, but we can do everything that we set out to do for the group, let's say OPEC, which we've been doing for the past week now. And I'll say why we motivate, our motivation for tracking OPEC is because of the coming meeting, and also because just yesterday we found out that Kuwait is the fourth country within the Gulf OPEC countries to have raised the price of gasoline. They removed subsidies. And the reason why countries have been doing that this year is because they want to lower domestic consumption while in order to increase their output of crude to the world market. Now, everyone wants to do that ahead of a meeting. They want to be at their very highest output level. So I shall hand this over to Lisa, who can talk more about our tanker tracking activities.
Yeah, like Sam mentioned, we've been tracking various different parts and countries all over the world. So we have focused more on the China, Russia and OPEC. So with OPEC, we're tracking over 100 different parts within the 14 different OPEC members, OPEC countries. Now, for the the week that we've just almost completed, we tried focusing our efforts to try and find the best processes in which we can accumulate all the data, the most efficient way and the most accurate way. Now, within the first 5 days of the week that we tracked the OPEC exports, the daily average that we managed to gather up was about 22 million barrels per day across the 14 different countries. Now, that has recently reduced over the last 2 days. We've now got a daily average of just under 19 million barrels. So we're thinking that that's obviously something to do with all the different issues with Saudi, all the different issues with OPEC. Now, we're tracking currently 492 tankers, and we've got total barrel export of 150 million thereabouts for now. Obviously, this is ongoing. So we've also been tracking China. So across China, we've tracked 47 parts. Now, the 13 days that we tracked it, we started tracking China on the 2nd of August. Now, that obviously had a major impact due to the typhoon. So we tracked 838 tankers. It came out at just short of 66 million barrels across the 13 days that we were tracking them. And it came out on average about 5 million barrels per day. Obviously, we're tracking China due to the statistics of the Bureau because they tend to be published a little bit behind. So we thought if we can keep on top of those, we'd be able to track them more to give a more accurate view and perspective. Russia, we've been tracking more to do with them dominating the Central and Eastern Europe crude oil market share. However, obviously, the other OPEC countries are now wanting to get involved a bit more. So the results that we managed to get for Russia, we're tracking 32 parts for Russia, which equated to 36 million barrels within the 7 day period that we were tracking, which was from the beginning of August to mid-August. And their daily average came out around 5 million barrels per day. So we're just trying to keep on top of everything just to try and keep things going. But our main focus is OPEC just because of the OPEC meetings coming up.
Lisa, that's fantastic. And it's really impressive if I look at the very famous American Petroleum Institute and how effective they are at predicting what's going to happen with inventory numbers versus the research you guys do. You guys do a lot better. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be interested in checking out the research that you do and finding out more about hashtag OOTT. Please tell us where we can find more information, what we can find there, and how interested listeners can get involved with your project.
The fastest possible way to find our research is by going to Twitter, typing in the hashtag OOTT, and you will find myself and Lisa as one of the contributors there. And you just click on our pinned tweets, and you'll find links to all the information that we work with. Yeah.
All right, so guys, don't forget to check out the OOTT hashtag on Twitter. So thanks for the update, guys, but unfortunately, we're out of time for this week. Eric, anything to add?
Well, it's the usual broken record. We need your help promoting the show, so we really appreciate if people could Retweet us when we announce the show. Tell your friends about it. We hope Zero Hedge will continue to cover us. They picked up the show a couple weeks ago, and it resulted in a dramatic increase in our listeners and registrations. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Aaron is to negotiate with the guests that you most want to get on the program for featured interviews. And as a result of registering, you will get our free research roundup email each week, which contains supporting materials for the feature interview, as well as the very best research that we could find on the internet. So, Aaron, please tell our listeners what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. So off the bat, I want to draw your attention to the latest investor letter and market outlook from Morgan Creek Capital Management. Now, it's a lengthy and worthwhile read, and you'll definitely want to check it out before our interview next week with Mark Yesko, founder and chief investment officer of Morgan Creek. So there's your assigned reading. Next, there's the latest interview of Jim Rickards with Sprott Global. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the war on cash, and in addition to claiming that governments have already won the war, Jim goes on to describe a possible war on gold once governments smarten up to the barbarous relic's reemergence as a true safe haven monetary metal. Now, finally, there is an excellent interview with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, founder and executive director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. Now, this interview talks about the growing social turmoil in Saudi Arabia, all within the context of global economics and geopolitical forces. This is definitely a great read if you want to understand what's happening in one of the biggest flashpoints in the world. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag, and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at underscore Aaron Chen underscore. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chen. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.